A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Glad you could join us as we explore another one of those ideas that, well, really sticks with you. Today we're getting into a foundational text, one that still feels incredibly fresh.
Oh, absolutely. And just so powerful. We're talking about Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. Mm-hmm. Our goal today really is to unpack Woolf's pretty revolutionary argument about what women need the actual conditions required to flourish creatively, intellectually. Right. And it's not just some dusty old book. These ideas, they pop up everywhere in conversations we're having right now.
They really do. When you think about the core themes, gender equality, economic independence, just having access to things, resources, and even how we think about creativity itself, it all just resonates so much today. It's almost, well, a bit unsettling how relevant it still is. Mm-hmm. It is unsettling. And, you know, what Woolf lays out, it goes beyond just women writers, doesn't it? It's this really insightful lens for understanding the sort of systemic things, the barriers that can stifle anyone's potential if they don't have those basic conditions for focused thought, for, you know, creation.
Right.
It makes you look past just individual talent and really consider the whole environment.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this. Virginia Woolf, born 1882, died in 1941. I mean, a giant of modernist literature, right?
That's absolutely.
Key figure in the Bloomsbury Group, that really influential circle of writers, artists, thinkers in England, and a pioneer of stream of consciousness, that narrative style that tries to capture, you know, the messy flow of thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Like in Mrs. Dalloway or To the Lighthouse. People probably know those.
Exactly.
And her own background, it's fascinating how it positioned her for this book. Mm. Born into this really intellectual family, loads of books around.
Yeah, but famously denied the formal university education her brothers got at Cambridge, or Oxbridge, as she calls it.
Right, so she's self-educated, basically, in her father's huge library. She experiences both this incredible intellectual hunger and that feeling of being shut out by the institutions. It's quite a paradox.
It really is, and she also dealt with personal struggles, mental illness, navigating the often quite harsh publishing world back then. That gave her a very real, intimate understanding of the challenges women face, specifically gender challenges.
And here's the crucial part for her argument. She actually got an inheritance, about £500 a year from an aunt.
Which was significant money, though.
Oh, absolutely. Life-changing money. That, plus having her own study, her actual literal room of one's own, meant she could live and write with the very independence she argues for. She lived it.
So she wasn't just theorizing.
Exactly. And she co-founded Hogarth Press with her husband, Leonard. So she wasn't just some outsider critiquing the literary world. She was in it, shaping it. She had the standing, the platform, and crucially, the lived experience to really dissect how the system worked, its biases, from the inside and out.
Okay, so the book itself, A Room of One's Own, it started as a couple of lectures she gave, right, at Cambridge Women's Colleges in 1928. On women in fiction.
That was the origin, yeah. But it clearly grew into something much bigger, much more profound than just lecture notes.
So what's the core argument? You said it was revolutionary.
It is, and it sounds almost deceptively simple when you first hear it. Yeah. Basically, a woman must have money and a room of her own if she's to write fiction. Mm-hmm. That's the line. But it's not just a snappy phrase. It's the absolute bedrock of the whole book, and it completely flips the script on how we usually think about creativity.
And the room, that's not just four walls and a door, is it?
No, not entirely. I mean, yes, it is partly about a literal private space with a lock, free from, you know, constant domestic duties and interruptions. Mm. That practical need is real.
But it's more.
But it's also this powerful metaphor, right? For intellectual freedom, for autonomy, for having the psychological space to think, to dream, to create, without society constantly breathing down your neck, judging you based on your gender. It's about having a mind that's really yours, unburdened.
Right, that psychological space. Yeah. And the money, that £500 a year.
That's the foundation, a practical bedrock for that freedom. It means a woman doesn't have to marry just for financial security. It means she doesn't have to compromise her artistic vision writing stuff just because it sells. It gives her integrity, space, the ability to pursue her art for its own sake.
Okay. So Woolf poses this big question. Why have there been so few women throughout history recognized as great writers? What was her answer? It wasn't just lack of talent.
No, definitely not. She cuts right through that. She says it's not about a lack of talent or even a different kind of talent. It's the systematic denial of those very things we just talked about, the money in the room. Yeah. Those are the conditions that foster genius. She saw creative potential as something that needs nurturing, needs the right conditions. It doesn't just magically appear out of nowhere. Essentially, she's arguing society itself has been actively complicit in stifling half its potential genius.
Wow. That really does flip things around. It puts the responsibility on the system, not the individual woman.
Exactly. It's not about individual failure. It's about society's systemic failure.
And the way she writes this, it's not like a dry textbook, is it?
Not at all. Yeah. That's part of his brilliance. She mixes everything, personal anecdotes, sharp historical analysis, literary criticism, even like fictional thought experiments. She uses this unnamed narrator, which is a clever device. It lets her guide you, the listener, on this intellectual journey. You move from these really concrete, everyday observations.
Like the bad food at the women's college.
Yes. To these sweeping historical insights and speculations.
Yeah.
It really hammers home the point that art and thought are tangled up with the material world, the practical realities of life.
Yeah.
And it ends up being this really powerful, though maybe understated, call for gender equality that goes way beyond just, you know, getting the vote.
Okay, let's dig into some of those sections. Chapter 1, The Material World of Men and Women. She starts right off with these tangible barriers, doesn't she?
Yeah, she talks about the narrator literally getting barred from an Oxbridge library. Just, nope, you're a woman.
Yeah.
And being told to get off the grass because it's only for the male fellows.
Keep off the grass.
And then that contrast, she draws the amazing lunch at the men's college, all stimulating conversation and good wine.
Compared to the pretty grim dinner at the women's college, Fernum. Clunes and custard, I think?
Something like that. It's dark. It really drives the point home, doesn't it? She uses these seemingly small things, library access, the quality of a meal to show something profound. That material wealth, comfort, freedom from just constant daily grind, it allows for expansive thinking, confidence. While poverty, deprivation, it leads to a more constrained, sometimes angrier intellectual life.
And that makes you think, doesn't it? About how our own surroundings, our daily comforts or lack of them, how they impact our ability to focus, to be creative. It's not just about fancy lunches. It connects to, say, the mental load of precarious work or constant digital noise.
Absolutely. That subtle erosion of the capacity for deep thought. It affects anyone, really, in our modern world.
Okay, so from the material world, she then moves into history in chapter 2, The Male-Centric View of History. The narrator heads to the British Museum looking for answers about women in books.
Right, looking for the truth. But what she finds is, well, revealing. Mountains of books about women, yes, but almost all written by men. And often, she notes, they're full of bias or anger or just dismissiveness. It's quite striking.
So Wolf's insight here is...
Her insight is that what we often take as objective knowledge, history itself, has been overwhelmingly shaped by male viewpoints, male anxieties. Mm-hmm. It creates this distorted picture of women. It's a brilliant deconstruction showing how male dominance isn't some natural fact. It's constructed, built through these narratives.
Which raises that question for us today, right? It's where do we still see those kinds of biases? Maybe more hidden now in media, in the stories we tell ourselves, and how vital it is to actively seek out different voices, different perspectives, to get anything close to a full picture.
Yeah, absolutely crucial.
Okay, building on that, chapter 3, this is probably the most famous bit, the fate of a female genius and that figure of Judith Shakespeare.
Judith. Yes, this incredible thought experiment. Wolf asks us to imagine William Shakespeare had a sister, Judith. Just as talented, just as brilliant.
But what happens to her?
Well, she's denied schooling. If she picks up a book, she's told to mend stockings instead. She's pushed into marriage young. She runs away to London, hoping to use her talent in the theater, but she's mocked, exploited, ends up pregnant, and tragically takes her own life.
It's heartbreaking.
It is. And it's such a powerful allegory. Wolf uses it to show that genius, even extraordinary talent like Shakespeare's, isn't enough. It needs opportunity, encouragement. A supportive structure. Judith's tragedy isn't her failure. It's society's failure to provide the conditions for her genius to flourish.
That idea of society's failure just echoes, doesn't it?
It does, and it leads into chapter 4, where she looks at the emergence of the woman writer.
Right.
She traces that slow, difficult path. She points to figures like Aphra Behn back in the 17th century, maybe the first English woman to actually earn a living from writing, proving it could be done.
A huge step.
A huge step. Then she talks about the 19th century novelists we know better, Jane Austen, the Brontes, George Eliot.
But her take is that even their incredible genius was constrained.
Yes. severely constrained by their circumstances.
Oh,
Austen, famously, writing in the common sitting room, hiding her pages when someone came in. Constant interruption. Bronte's work, Wolfe suggests, carries this jerk of anger born from her limitations. George Eliot, of course, used a man's name to be taken seriously.
Right.
So their achievements were immense, absolutely monumental. But Wolfe argues their art was often shaped, even distorted by those limitations, often confined to domestic settings because that's what they knew intimately.
It's fascinating how they navigated that. It makes you think about people today, you know, trying to pursue creative work alongside demanding jobs or family life.
Exactly. Always fighting for that little bit of room, that little bit of time. The struggle continues in different forms.
So after tracing this difficult history, does Wolfe offer some hope? What's chapter 5, A Glimpse of the Future, about?
It is about hope. The narrator picks up a fictional novel written by a contemporary woman, a character called Mary Carmichael. The novel's called Life's Adventure. And in it, the narrator finds this one sentence that she sees as revolutionary. Chloe liked Olivia.
Chloe liked Olivia. Why is that so significant?
Because, Wolfe argues, it shows women relating to each other. The relationship exists outside the context of men, fathers, husbands, lovers. It signals a shift towards women telling their own stories, representing their own relationships authentically beyond the male gaze. A new kind of female storytelling emerging.
Wow. Just that simple phrase.
Simple phrase. Huge implications. Though Wolfe does note that this fictional Mary Carmichael's writing is still a bit angular, a bit awkward, suggesting women are still in the process of breaking free from old literary forms and forging their own unique styles, their own sentences.
That excitement of seeing your own experience reflected in art for the first time, that must have been huge.
Imagine. And it sets the stage for the final chapter, chapter 6, which is maybe the most visionary, The Androgynous Mind.
The androgynous mind. What does she mean by that?
This is Wolfe's idea for the ultimate state of creative freedom. She proposes this concept of a mind that isn't rigidly divided along gender lines. It's a mind that can draw on and unite both conventionally masculine and feminine ways of thinking and perceiving, transcending those limitations.
So who has this kind of mind?
She suggests the greatest artists, using Shakespeare as an example again, possessed this kind of unified consciousness. They could create with a sense of wholeness. They weren't distracted by needing to defend their sex or prove a point about gender. Their minds were, in her words, incandescent. Unimpeded.
That's a fascinating vision.
It is. It's her hope for the future that literature and maybe all thought becomes richer and more complete when it arises from this kind of psychological integration.
But couldn't that idea be seen as, I don't know, maybe glossing over the importance of specific female experience, especially when fighting oppression? Does focusing on transcendence risk erasure?
That's a really important critique, and Wolfe is subtle here. She absolutely acknowledges the historical and political necessity for women to write about their specific experiences, their anger, their injustices. That's crucial. But her ideal for the highest form of art is one where the artist, having achieved the necessary freedom, the room, the money, can move beyond the immediate battle. Not to erase female experience, but so that the art isn't solely defined or distorted by the fight against oppression.
Oh, okay. It's about the freedom to choose the focus rather than having it dictated by circumstance.
Precisely. It's a nuanced argument for artistic freedom ultimately residing beyond the immediate political fray once that freedom is actually secured.
Okay. So, pulling back, let's think about the big themes here. First, obviously, economic independence as the absolute foundation of freedom.
Yes, that core Wolfe idea.
Mm.
Creativity isn't just some lofty abstract thing. It's grounded in material reality. No money, no autonomy. Potential gets stifled.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? How does knowing you have some security, financial or otherwise, free up your mind? Allows you to take risks, explore ideas.
It's hard to be creative when you're constantly stressed about basic survival.
True. And that connects to the next theme, the institutional nature of oppression. Wolfe is brilliant at showing it's not just about individual bad actors or prejudice.
Right. It's embedded in the systems. Universities, laws, customs, publishing houses, all those structures that subtly or not so subtly exclude or disadvantage certain groups.
Those little exclusions she described, the library, the grass they add up.
They do. And it prompts you to look around your own life, your workplace. Where are those subtle institutional barriers still operating, even if there's no overt discrimination? Access to networks, mentorship, whose work gets valued.
It really changes how you see things, which leads to the psychology of it all, how oppression and privilege actually affect people's minds.
Yeah, Wolfe observes how inequality messes with everyone's psychology. For the oppressed group, it could lead to self-doubt, maybe aiming lower. For the privileged group, perhaps a need to constantly assert superiority to justify their position.
It gets internalized.
Exactly. It's like this mental tax that drains energy, saps creativity. Yeah. You start wondering how those societal messages might still be shaping your own internal monologue, your sense of what's possible, even in supposedly equal spaces.
And then finally, that idea of the unity of human potential linked to the androgynous mind.
Right. That these rigid gender boxes we create limit everyone. That integrating the qualities society artificially splits leads to richer, fuller human expression and achievement.
It's a call for wholeness, really.
It is, and it makes you ask, how could embracing a wider range of perspectives, challenging those binary ways of thinking, enhance your own understanding, your own work, your own life?
It's powerful stuff. And the book itself, it's just full of lines that stick with you, isn't it? Wolf could really turn a phrase.
Oh, absolutely. Packed with memorable lines that just distill these huge ideas into poetry, almost.
Like the main thesis itself. A woman must have money and a room of her own if she is to write fiction. We've talked about it a lot, but it just cuts right to the chase. Creativity needs resources. No romanticizing the starving artist here.
None at all. And then there's that incredibly poignant one. For most of history, Anonymous was a woman.
Oof. Yeah.
It just perfectly captures centuries of lost voices, erased contributions, the sheer weight of women denied recognition for their work, their ideas.
And from chapter 5, that deceptively simple line, Chloe liked Olivia.
Yeah, the quiet revolution, signaling women finally being seen in relation to each other, outside of men's stories, charting that new territory for authentic female experience in literature.
Then there's the one that grounds it all in reality. Intellectual freedom depends upon material things. Poetry depends upon intellectual freedom.
Mm-hmm. No messing about there. High thought, art, they need a practical foundation. Freedom from basic worry is essential for the mind to truly soar.
And lastly, that beautiful, hopeful vision she offers. If we live another century or so, and have 500 a year each of us, and rooms of our own, then the opportunity will come, and the dead poet, who was Shakespeare's sister, will put on the body which she has so often laid down.
Such a powerful image, a prophecy almost, a belief that when the conditions are finally right, all that suppressed genius will finally emerge.
So thinking about today, how do we actually apply these ideas from nearly a century ago? What are the real life applications?
Well, on a personal level, for creativity or just focused work, Wolf's advice is still gold. Try to create that dedicated space, even if it's small, even if it's just protected time. Reduce distractions. Aim for financial stability where possible, because that anxiety really does kill creativity. Protect time just to think, to contemplate.
So if you're listening and trying to write or learn something new or start a project,
ask yourself, how are you actively carving out your room, your money, which might just mean protected time, freedom from constant demands? It requires conscious effort.
Definitely. And in the workplace, Wolf's analysis of those institutional barriers being excluded from networks, maybe not having the same resources or mentorship, it's still so relevant.
Yeah, think about meetings. Who gets to speak? Who feels confident speaking? Who have the time and resources to really prepare?
We need to look at our workplace practices for those subtle exclusions. Make sure there's genuinely equal access to opportunities, to training, to mentorship, because those small things really do add up over a career.
And then there's how we engage with the world's social and cultural critique. Wolf basically trains us to be critical readers, critical consumers of media, of history, to always ask, who's telling this story? What might their biases be? Whose voice is missing?
Right. Whose experience is centered here? Whose is ignored? It makes you a much more active, thoughtful consumer of information.
For sure. And finally, maybe for parenting or education, that story of Judith Shakespeare, it's such a stark reminder. Nurture talent equally, regardless of gender stereotypes. Provide not just emotional support, but practical resources too. Encourage curiosity everywhere. Create environments where kids feel free to explore all their interests.
Yeah, actively pushing back against those gender stereotypes in toys and subjects and expectations, giving every child their own room to grow into whoever they are. You know, what really struck me doing this deep dive was just how brilliantly Wolf connects big ideas, freedom, creativity to really concrete material things, like the quality of a meal or having a door with a lock.
Yeah.
It forces you to see how deeply our environment, our physical circumstances shape our potential. It's not just about willpower.
Totally agree. And for me, It was that vision of the androgynous mind. It's so forward-looking. It's not just about equality in the sense of women getting a slice of the existing pie. It's about transforming the pie itself, achieving a more complete, more harmonious human consciousness, getting beyond those limiting gender categories for the benefit of everyone's thinking, everyone's art. It's incredibly ambitious and inspiring.
It really is. So this deep dive, I think, leaves us with a powerful reminder. Individual genius doesn't just spring out of nowhere. It's nurtured. It needs the right conditions, often created by collective effort. So the final thought for you, the listener, might be, how can you, in your own sphere, help create those necessary rooms and money, literally or metaphorically, for potential to flourish in your community for the future?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.